You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 5th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. The literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I am back, still alive, ladies and gentlemen. Only at about 75%. But 75% of Sam Cedar is probably close to 78% of any other broadcaster. Today on the program, Ari Berman of The Nation, recently back from Britain. Talk to us about how that British austerity is going, because we may, if our elites have their way, we may see it here. He'll also, try and get me out of my massive depression caused by the exit of Herman Cain from the Republican primary sweepstakes. The clown car got a little bit roomier over the weekend. A real shame, ladies and gentlemen, from my perspective. He brought something absolutely surreal to the Republican primary. And now all we're left is a bunch of other just less interesting con man, bullshit artists, and pathetic losers. Also on the program, an update, Occupy Your Homes starting tomorrow. Finally get to those Walker stories. I don't know if I did that in Wisconsin. Interesting story on fracking. And are we already engaged in a war with Iran? Sure sounds like it. We will get to that as the program continues. Well, here's an interesting report from Michael Hirsch, writing for the National Journal. In response to yesterday, Iran's claim of shooting down a U.S. drone and an explosion outside of the British embassy in Bahrain, there is increased speculation that essentially the United States and perhaps its allies, Israel, and perhaps Britain, have been engaged in a growing covert war with Iran, and that we're starting to see Iran strike back in its own sort of covert way. Asked why the United States, in cooperation with Israel, was now engaged in a covert war against Iran's nuclear program that may include the Stuxnet virus, the blowing up of facilities, and the assassination or kidnapping of scientists, one recently retired U.S. official, privy to up-to-date intelligence, would not deny it. Interesting to see if there's going to be more reporting on this. You know, generally, we understand that when your government is engaged in a war, the people should know about it. But I know that's so quaint. What a quaint notion. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great Ari Berman of The Nation magazine. Always a pleasure. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program from The Nation magazine, author of Herding Donkeys, the great Ari Berman. Hello, Ari.
Hello, Sam. The pleasure is always mine.
It's even a greater pleasure for me. And I am now fortunately recovering from my one of the worst head colds I've ever had. Chest cold, head cold, all of it.
Yikes. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Well, yes, thank you. I appreciate your sympathies. Now, I understand, Ari, while I was sick, still working, not in bed, not resting, but you were in Great Britain during the big, nearly 2 million person, is that right, public worker strike in Great Britain?
Yeah, so I was actually there right before the strikes. I had a planned trip over there, and I met with a bunch of people in progressive and union political circles as they were planning the strike, but I had to come back for the actual strike, so I followed it from afar. But it was a really big day. I mean, it was the largest strike in Britain since the winter of discontent in 1979. It was the first time that labor has really mobilized, labor unions, I should say, not the Labour Party, has mobilized a huge number of their constituents and members to protest the government's austerity policies. And I think it comes at a time when the public in general is really souring on what the British Conservatives are doing over there and have implemented, and I think what the very stuff that Republicans would like to be able to implement over here.
Now, a couple questions. First off, you know, there was a report last week, which is it's from the OBR, I guess. It's sort of like their CBO, I guess.
Yeah, it's like their CBO.
That they are downgrading their GDP projections from 2.5% to 0.7%. Next year. I mean, their austerity program has been a dismal failure, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's been a dismal failure, and it's one that we can see in practice. So we get a sense from looking at Britain how what the Republicans advocate for the economy, what impact it would actually have over here. So conservatives came in 2010 in Britain preaching this mantra of expansionary austerity, which myself and Paul Krugman and a lot of other people have subsequently looked at and debunked. I should say that I didn't personally debunk it. I have just sort of reported on those who have debunked it. But basically what happened is they came in and they said, by cutting spending, by cutting government, we are going to boost the economy. And in fact, the exact opposite has happened. Unemployment is rising, growth is slowing, basically to a halt. And the problem is that it's a vicious circle, right? So they say, we have too much debt, we need to cut spending. The problem is then the economy doesn't grow, people don't have jobs, and actually it's harder then to pay off the debts. But Britain's in a situation where their lead spokesman on the economy, George Osborne, basically said, we're going to stick with these austerity policies for the next 5 years. We're going to eliminate 700,000 public sector jobs. And I believe that the public is going to be very unhappy with that.
700,000 is nearly one fifth, right, of their public sector workforce?
I don't know the exact number of their total public sector workforce, but I mean, it's a very significant number. I mean, there's only 50 million people, I think, in Britain overall. So you're talking about 700,000 jobs in a country like that. I mean, it's very, very, very significant. I mean, since our recession began, we've lost over 500,000 public
right.
sector jobs. No one really talks about it, but it's had a major impact in prolonging the recession. And so really the government over there has declared war on public sector workers. And that really left the unions with no choice but to strike, because they're in a situation where in this particular crisis, they're being asked to increase their pension contributions by 3%. They're asked to retire later. They've already been forced into a pay freeze. And now they've also been told that 700,000 jobs of theirs are going to disappear. And so really the only way that they can change this dynamic is getting out in the street and calling attention to these austerity policies, and basically making the argument that not only are they being scapegoated, but the government's policies are going to hurt people all across the board, not just those in organized
labor. How much of an impact do you think their strike is going to have, or is that sort of difficult to measure at this point?
Well, I think it could help in two ways. Number one, it could get them a stronger position at the bargaining table, and there's some indications that will actually happen. So they could actually get a better deal with the pensions, and they could perhaps convince the Tory Liberal government coalition to back away from some of these cuts. The other thing they can do is just frame the argument for the public, because my feeling is the public over there is going to get very restless, because essentially the government has said for the next 5 years we're going to pursue policies that aren't going to improve the economy. I mean, they didn't say it in that way, but that's essentially what they're doing. And I think the longer this goes on, the more restless the public will be, and I think they'll be sympathetic to the unions as opposed to being sympathetic to the government. And in the same way that labor unions and Occupy Wall Street have been able to crystallize the message here in terms of the 99% versus the 1%, I mean, you could also see a similar dynamic emerging over there.
To what extent do labor unions in Great Britain communicate with labor unions in this country? I mean, you know, we saw UK Uncut jump to the U.S., become U.S. Uncut, which U.S. Uncut seems to have basically just essentially rolled into Occupy Wall Street. To what extent, when unions will take an action like this, do they communicate with unions in this country?
Well, you have to remember, unions in Britain are 28% of the workforce. In America, they're only 11% of the workforce. So they're just a lot bigger over there. Now, they've suffered significant declines. They were 50% in 1979 before Margaret Thatcher took over. But nonetheless, they are still a significant, I mean, over a fourth of the sector, a fourth of the size of the overall workforce. So they just have more clout in general. I mean, so they can communicate with U.S. labor unions, and I think there is some back and forth here, but it's just a different dynamic. I mean,
right.
If we had a general strike of unions in this country, I mean, it would matter, but it wouldn't have the impact that it has over in Britain. But the important thing is, what impact will this have in the rest of Europe? Because the rest of Europe is heavily unionized, and if they start really protesting the government's austerity policies across the board, that could actually make, I think, a big impact.
My understanding is that that's about to happen in Italy today, this morning, I guess. And on the eve of a big summit that's happening in Europe to deal with this, and there's reports as to whether or not France and Germany have come to some type of agreement about making a tighter European Union within the European Union. But what was clear is that Italy has announced a major austerity package, and there's video out there. I don't speak Italian. But of the Italian, I know that comes as a shock to you, Ari. The Italian Minister of Social Affairs, a woman named Elsa Fornero, and she is announcing that retirees are going to have to deal with new Prime Minister Monti's austerity program, and she's actually breaking down in tears talking about it. And my understanding is that the Italian labor unions are already talking about a massive strike. That's not a huge – I mean, in Italy, the strikes at the very least over the years have been fairly common, if I'm not mistaken. But this could just spread across the continent.
Yeah, and the real problem with Europe is that Germany has pursued basically a very laissez form of economics in response to the crisis. Yes, they've put some money in to bailing countries out, but they've been much more like the Tea Party than they have been like a liberal government. And the European Central Bank has been very, very hands-off. They haven't taken any efforts like the Fed has here to try to buy this debt off and stabilize these countries. And what's happened instead is they're telling countries, okay, you need to implement these austerity measures. And so this is happening in Greece, it's happening in Italy. The problem is that these countries don't have the money to really implement these austerity measures. And when they do implement the austerity measures, their economy slows. And then again, this vicious circle happens where they're not actually able to pay off the debt. And then so then more austerity is asked of them. And then it becomes even harder for them to pay off the debt. So clearly, I think austerity policies alone are not going to get Europe out of this crisis. And that's why you're seeing increasing calls for the European Central Bank to become more aggressive. You're seeing increased calls for Germany to basically suck it up and give more money to these countries, pump more money into these countries to be able to save Europe. Or the alternative is that basically the thinking is that there's going to have to be a significant dissolution of the EU and the Eurozone, whether everyone leaves or some countries leave. But that's a pretty catastrophic scenario in and of itself, because that could cause major unrest there, and that would probably spill over to our economy as well. So that's why I think they're trying to save the union as opposed to dissolving it right now.
Yeah, I mean, I still go back to this notion, literally, I think it was a year ago, maybe a little bit more, I was on the Radigan show when the Brits were starting the austerity thing. And, he made a big point of saying, we're going to have a test case now. We'll see what happens. Now, of course, now that we do see what happens, we never hear anything about British austerity. But I wonder if that has – I mean, do you have a sense that what's happening in Britain in some way dampens the austerity fire here? Or is it just that – for whatever reason, Obama shifted sometime around Labor Day, and now we're in campaign mode, and nobody's going to try and do that now.
Well, it should have shifted it empirically, because anyone who's studied Britain has seen that it's been a failure. The problem over here is that we have, as I've written and we talked about on your show, this very strong austerity class that just wants to believe in austerity no matter what the evidence is, and they're very well funded. I don't think they're getting a whole lot of traction, though, quite frankly. I mean, the super committee was basically a total failure. The Obama campaign has shifted somewhat half-heartedly and belatedly into pushing for jobs over austerity. And it's interesting to go over to Europe, because you're reminded that things are actually worse over there than they are here. I mean, seriously, Tim Geithner is basically regarded as a progressive fellow across the pond, which I found sort of shocking, because the alternative is George Osborne, right? The UK finance minister, who is just significantly more conservative in his policies. So I mean, the Obama administration, although we have criticized them a lot for being not nearly as aggressive as they could be in tackling the recession, they are actually an antidote right now to the austerity that's basically ballooning around Europe at the moment. But I do think there is limited enthusiasm for this now. It isn't working empirically, and people are looking for alternative solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's going to make 2012 so interesting is how aggressive Occupy Wall Street gets and how much that's heard in Washington. And let's take this moment just briefly to turn our eyes to the 2012 election campaign. I don't do a lot of coverage of it. I've been covering Kane a lot because there's just so rarely such a mix of complete insanity and that type of national exposure. I guess, well, let me rephrase that. You know, in the news sector. Well, let me rephrase that too. I don't know how to put it, but I just thought he was wonderful. I think it's a real shame he's out of the race because in some ways he was the most naked expression of what the Republican primary is.
Well, and it's funny because Newt Gingrich, is, I was just thinking about this today, I mean, is basically a slightly more polished version of Herman Cain. I mean,
absolutely.
Let's be real. He's Herman Cain with experience. I mean, that's really all it is. I mean, he's a complete huckster. His personal life is an absolute disaster. He probably knows what he's talking about on issues. I would certainly hope that he knows what he's talking about better than Kane, but right. I didn't find it all surprising that Kane drops out and a day later says he's endorsing Newt. And you kind of wonder what the Romney camp would say. Like, if Kane offered to endorse Romney, would the Romney people be like, actually, no thank you?
No, they would take it. Are you kidding? Of course they would take it. It would take it in a minute. You're right. I mean, look, Newt is, I think, significantly more informed than Cain, but the similarity is that their own self-delusions about themselves mm-hmm. make them completely incomprehensible.
Yeah,
they just go into areas they have no business of being in, and they are both hucksters. They're both just in this for a buck.
Well, it's a different level of pretension. Cain didn't know anything and pretended that he knew something. Gingrich knows something and he pretends that he knows everything.
Right.
So, and his sort of crackpot historical novels become elevated to, you know, first rate scholarship. But I've always felt this interesting dynamic, Sam, because I've always felt, and I'd be interested in your take on this, that there was always kind of two Republican primaries. There was the primary that it always seemed like Mitt Romney was definitely going to win, and the sort of adult in the room primary, and then there was the sideshow primary. And to an extent, I think with the Gingrich emergence, they're merging, that the sideshow primary and the Romney primary are now one Republican primary, and for better or for worse, Newt is for sure the anti-Romney now. There's not going to be another anti-Romney. And I still find it hard to imagine him actually pulling this thing off, but it looks slightly more conceivable now than it did 2 or 3 weeks ago.
I think that what we have learned is that there, in fact, weren't always two Republican primaries. There was one. And the question was, you know, could Mitt Romney, the ultimate two-faced, you know, amorphous salamander, essentially, could he remain unscathed through this process? Like, how many times would he have to change his colors, and how deeply would he have to change his colors to win this race? And what it's looking like is he's going to have to get full-on bat crap crazy. I think it's quite possible. I mean, I think people underestimated, I certainly did, just how much like visceral dislike there is of Mitt Romney in the Republican Party.
Or how much visceral dislike there is of Barack Obama. Because seriously, I mean, the rationale for Gingrich's candidacy is, yes, he's a flip-flopper too, but he'll be tougher on Obama. Like you can't just hate him a lot. You have to like hate him with every bone in your body to be the nominee. And I wonder if this sort of irrational rage is going to hurt them when it comes to election time. Because I, you know, for all his flaws, I just think Romney would be a much tougher candidate
Definitely.
For Obama to run against,
you know,
than Gingrich would.
I don't know who it is that wrote this, and so my apologies to whoever that person was. But the gist of it was that the entire GOP primary is a function. The winner will be a function of just how much they show that they're willing to attack liberals. as people. You know what I mean? Like that is why you have seen this parade of people, because theoretically Santorum is just as conservative in God Squad as the rest of them. But Santorum has not made a living of being sort of like a bomb thrower, you know, like a barbist, if you will. And guys like Kane, certainly, Bachman, definitely, Gingrich, definitely, Perry. People thought that he was the type of guy who would throw barbs at Democrats, and then people realized that he was too medicated to put together an entire sentence, essentially.
The sort of prerequisite to having a successful barb is being able to say it in
exactly.
form, I think.
No, exactly. And to have the mental faculties, you know, I think he's got some type of drug issue, frankly, maybe his back pain or whatever it is. And so I think that's what we're seeing here. And I think this is simply a reflection of what the Republican Party is. You know, you can get away with this in localized races, this type of stuff, like, you know, in congressional races. Maybe on some level you can get away with it on statewide races, but you see they have much tougher time with in terms of, like, Senate seats. I don't think they can get away with it in a presidential election. And, you know, it's just one more example of how Barack Obama is the luckiest politician in the history of America.
There's a pure – Gingrich is certainly a pure reflection of where the Republican primary has been moving, right? Because, I mean, you essentially had, through the Bush years, a big government in the sense of massive giveaways to corporate America – spend, you know, as much money as you want, enriching your campaign benefactors, and basically that's what Gingrich was. I mean, that's who Gingrich was. And then they rebranded themselves as the Tea Party. And Gingrich, I think, is better placed than Romney to pick up on that, because Romney is basically, I mean, like George, I think it was George Will who wrote, Newt deviated from conservative orthodoxy, and Romney deviated from nowhere. In the sense that right. we don't know if who he really is. Was he a moderate who just that fit the one he ran against in Massachusetts, or, you know, was he a conservative who governed as more of a moderate because he had a Democratic legislature? And now is he a conservative because he's free to say what he finally believes, or is he just masking it, or does he really believe nothing and just will say whatever he needs to say to be able to win? I basically think it's probably the latter, right?
Right.
But it is, I mean, it is weird that a party that's so enthralled to Tea Party orthodoxy would essentially take a guy who has no known record on any of these issues.
But there is no Tea Party orthodoxy. The only Tea Party orthodoxy, I am convinced, is, well, there's two part. One is they want more God in government. You know, this myth that it's all about financial constraints and conservative idea. That, I mean, if the Tea Party was ever that, it was that for 5 minutes, at least, you know, post the Ron Paul Tea Party. You know, there were two Tea Parties. There was the Ron Paul Tea Party, and then there was the Cuccinelli version of the Tea Party, which had about a 5 minute window when they were talking about finance. And then it was all just God and another way of saying, I'm an Ann Coulter fan, essentially. You know, the latest round of Ann Coulterism. And so, I think the only thing, and that's why Newt Gingrich is doing so well, because, I mean, who is more like Ann Coulter than Newt Gingrich? You know, I mean, Newt Gingrich is Ann Coulter in a suit with 1,000 more pounds on him and had worked in government. I mean, that's the only thing he is.
Well, I think it's fair. I think there's probably in some ways two Tea Parties. I mean, I think some of the rank and file activists truly were revolted by the Bush years and would like to see smaller government and would like to see Republicans actually stand to that. But I do agree with you that most of the Republican Party didn't have any ideological change of heart. They just rebranded themselves as Tea Partiers, and Newt probably fits better with that line of thinking. I don't think Romney fits well with either line of thinking, though, and that's why you're seeing the Republican base just not coalesce around him, no matter what.
Are we going to make a bet who's going to win the primary?
Well, I still think Romney's going to win. What do you think?
You know, I'm really starting to think he could lose. I'm really.
But
starting
are you willing
to? Am I willing
bet
to bet
on it?
We may have to wait for our next phone call because Ari still owes me $200. Everybody.
It's true. It's true. And I think you should. I think we should make another bet. I think you should stick to your Obama getting 52% again. 2012.
It's a function of who the candidate is, but I actually am starting to think about it because I think Romney. I think there's a pretty good chance. I mean, Newt may end up being the nominee.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, forget about it. I don't even know if he makes it to Election Day.
Some people were saying that there's this new line of thinking in the Republican Party that somehow or another Newt will be a stronger candidate than Romney in a general election. But I just find it very hard to believe that that would be the case.
Look, I don't think you can underestimate how much the Republican base hates Mormons. I really don't. I don't think you can overestimate it.
But don't you think that argument's neutralized with the black guy in the White House who they think is a Muslim?
No, I think the black foreign-born Muslim that you know is better than the Satan worshiper that you don't for these people. I really do. Well, I really do. Because I'll tell you something. Even these evangelical fundamentalists, they know a black guy. There's a black guy in their church. There is no Mormon in their church. And I think that's the difference.
Well, maybe that's true. I find it hard to believe. I think for the same people that don't like Romney because he's a Mormon, don't like Obama because he's a Muslim in their eyes, and this argument is basically neutralized. The bigotry is neutralized.
I don't think so. And that's the part of the problem. You don't want it to be neutralized because you want them to get out there and
be
fervent.
The part of the problem that I have.
All right, we've run out of time, buddy. Okay. We're going to have to continue this another day.
All right, sounds good. I appreciate it. Bye.
Ari Berman, folks, from The Nation Magazine. We'll be right back. We've got a couple stories to talk about. Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? We are back, folks. Incidentally, the new normal involves me taking longer times at the breaks to hawk up part of my lung and try and blow my nose. Folks, it's a time in the program before we get to the next news story where I say, please become a member. We had like a momentary burst of member signing upage during our marathon, and now we're back down to that slow pace. I understand it's the holidays, but you know what makes a great gift? And not just like a gift that, wow, you're showing that you, that somebody you like to talk to politics about, you're showing them, I'm going to give them a gift of a Majority Report membership. It's a twofer. Because what you're doing is you're supporting the show and you're turning somebody else on to the show. And it's a threefer. You're getting credit for giving them a gift. Now, it also makes a great spite gift. Your uncle, your grandpa, your grandma, they're a nut job conservative. You just pretend like you didn't know. Here's a membership to this podcast I think you're really going to appreciate. It's a twofer. It's a threefer. It could be a fourfer. You can also support this show by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm. And folks, your membership, not only does it pay the guys in this office, the guys and gals, not only does it pay for me and pay for our equipment, we're going to get a new website. What does that mean for you? I don't know. I'm not sure, but it's going to be great looking. It's going to be suitable for a 2011 podcast award in news and politics podcast, one that has over 1 million downloads in their first year. So become a member today. Support the show in any way you can. That includes giving reviews on iTunes and buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Here's a hint for you. Los Dioses. Is that what it is? Dioses. That's the one that Nikki likes. I like the Ethiopian, but it's all fair trade. Labor Department released its jobs report for November on Friday. Showed that the number of employed high school graduates actually fell by 187,000 over the last 12 months. The number of employed college graduates has gone up by 1.1 million during the same period. However, so, you know, that notion about the value of a college degree that we had a little mini debate on the better half of the program last week, I think it's fairly clear. This is not to say that if you don't have a college degree, you can't be a success. Of course you can. But I think statistically, having a college degree helps you. Now, one could also argue that the type of person who goes to college may come from an economic background where they have more connections. That's also true, too. So it's difficult to parse. But that's the sort of the uninterpreted data anyways. However, more than half of all unemployed workers from the ages 45 to 54 have been out of work for 6 months or more. Among unemployed 55 to 64-year-olds, close to 60% have been searching for work for more than 6 months. Regardless of whether or not you're college educated or not. Now, the point of this is that when we talk about chaining the CPI, cutting people's Social Security benefits, these are the people who are going to be entering into Social Security. These are the people who are going to be entering into Medicare. If you're between 55 and 64 years old, and 60% of people in that age group who are unemployed have been looking for more than 6 months, statistically speaking, you got to think that there is a significant portion of those who are simply going to stumble, no work, into Medicare or Social Security with a lot of debt. They're going to need that Social Security. Now, I know we're all living to 140 years old now, so the idea of retirement at age 67, a lot of these people will have to take early retirement, which would mean reduced benefits to begin with. But the idea of retirement at 67, well, that's a vacation, you know, says all the people who work by writing on their ass and sending in a story to the newspaper or talking on television. Exhausting. Exhausting. I don't see how I'm going to be able to do that past the age of 50. Also, according to a new study released on Friday by the John J. Haldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers, 7% of those who lost jobs after the financial crisis, only 7%, have returned to or exceeded their previous financial position and maintained their lifestyles. 15% say the reduction in their incomes has been drastic and will probably be permanent. It's all right. Come on. Let's cut Social Security.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd. Lay, hoodlay, hoodlay, hee-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd. Lay, hoodlay, hoodaloo.
And again, speaking to that point about college, according to Rutgers study, those with less education were most ravaged by job loss during the recession. Even among those who found work, many made much less than before the downturn. Uh, Of the 13.1 million people still searching for work, more than 42% have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. 8.9 million more are working part-time because they can't find full-time work. Hey, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Unemployment insurance? Hey, come on. It's a waste of time, folks. Unemployment benefits cost taxpayers, individual taxpayers, $184.7 billion over the past 4 years. The rest of the remaining of the 434, so 250 or so billion paid by employers. So the companies have paid for that unemployment insurance. It's always been that way. Federal has to kick in money, though, federal budget, when they get off of state state unemployment. It is also, well, relative to things like tax cuts, Social Security tax cuts, one of the best stimuluses that we have for the economy. So not only does it help people who are out of work, it basically creates other jobs.
How can that be, Sam?
Well, because these people are unemployed, have no source of income. And they take their unemployment checks and they go out and they buy things with it. And the way that you create jobs is by creating aggregate demand.
That's ridiculous. The free market creates jobs.
I don't know what that is, what you're talking about, the free market.
You don't like liberty?
No, I like liberty. I just don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, why can't we have a civil conversation?
Click. Playing the part of that libertarian was me today. Though we will take phone calls from libertarians at 646-257-3920 as we transition into the better half of the program. In the better half of the program, interesting story about fracking. Apparently, you got to read those contracts very, very carefully. But one thing a fracking company knows, that they can afford lawyers that should be able to write a contract so that the lawyers that people have in rural communities just can't parse until the day comes when you realize, like, hey, wait a second, why are those fracking trucks driving away? You guys left that big, you know, that big pond of all that chemical waste that you created? You left that. Hello? And then the fracking lawyer comes over and says, oh, yeah, yeah, you said that was okay based upon the contract you signed. Oh. Oh, I just read the part about you giving me money. Yeah. Yeah, we gave you a lot of money. You have plenty of money now to clean it up. But that's going to cost all my money. Yeah. Yeah. That's the price we all have to pay to have this very cheap source of clean energy. Clean insofar as when we burn it, not so much when we dig for it. And cheap insofar as we don't pay all the costs. I'll also give you an update on Occupy Your Homes and what's happening in Wisconsin. Scott Walker, you're about to be recalled.
That's Occupy Our Homes.
It is Occupy Our Homes, but the website is occupyyourhome.org. Take that, social media expert, web expert. All right, folks, you can IM me at Majority FM. Look at that. Matt, completely silenced. You can call me at 646-257-3920. You can IM me. I will be doing Radigan today. with a much better voice than I had last time. See you in a minute.